Jimmy Muyaha is leading the conversation all across South Africa right now. Stay tuned to SAFM.
Thank you to Greg for that news update. There'll be more news with Greg at 7 o'clock. Right now on this day in 1901, the first and what we would later know as the second Prime Minister of South Africa were fighting the British on two fronts. Interestingly enough, both the Prime Minister Louis Botha and Jan Smuts, who would then become Prime Minister thereafter, were involved in two separate battles on this day. In 1940, on this day, the Operation Sea Lion would be postponed indefinitely. For those that don't remember that, that was the operation by Adolf Hitler announcing that Germany would invade Britain. I guess he had second thoughts. Maybe he got cold feet. Either way, it didn't happen. In 1964, on this day, the Beatles would make $150,000 in one day, in one performance. That would be a record for that particular performance, or that would be a record at that time, rather. It would be a performance in a Kansas City on their day off at the polite request of a Kansas City businessman who happened to own a baseball club at the time as well. In 1966, on this day, Mission Impossible, the series, would begin on CBS long before Tom Cruise decided to make movies about it. In 1999, on this day, the former president, Thabo Mbeki, would receive an honorary doctorate from the Rand Afrikaans University, which we now know has become a UJ. In 2021, on this day, Squid Games would premiere on Netflix. You're tuned into the SAFM Market Update with MoneyWeb. I'm your host, Jimmy Muyaha, and on the show today, we chat to HighProp. We take a look at the results for their year ended June 2024. We have a conversation around those numbers and get a sense of that performance with the CEO, Morne Wilken. Then we have a conversation with Denker Capital's Corky Koyman around the Itala conversation. It seems as though the Prudential Authority has come out with a bit more details around why they chose not to renew that exemption for Itala and what it could potentially mean for Itala as a business, understanding that they do still hold some client deposits and some monies on behalf of citizens. Then we have a conversation with Anu Labuskagni of My Broadband around the Starlink debacle. ICASA says there's no application. Elon Musk says there's an application. The president says we must have Starlink in South Africa. We try to get to the bottom of it. We try to understand what's happening there and whether or not we'll end up getting Starlink. Then, because it is a Tuesday, we're taking a look at a property feature this week. It's not the turn of Agri Tuesday, it is Property Tuesday's turn this week, and we're taking a look at the real cost of renting, the implications that come with it, and some of the hidden costs we might need to be aware of that you should probably read your lease agreement for.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
We begin with a market update, taking a look at what has been moving the markets throughout the day. I'm joined on the line by founder at Just One Lap, Simon Brown, to take a look at some of these movements throughout the day. Good evening, Si. Thanks so much for taking the time. Let's start with markets coming back with a vengeance, seemingly fighting back ahead of the interest rate decision that is all but priced in to take place tomorrow. Equity markets across the world, including South Africa, having a really good day.
Jimmy, evening, 100%. I thought you were going to say to me, where were the winners? And the winners were everywhere. And I'm looking at my screen, and we're talking local. They're all up over a percent, nicely up over a percent. If I look at my heat map, there's some red out there. But, I mean, it's barely more than a handful of red stocks and some big movers. And as you point out, I mean, we've got FOMC tomorrow, we've got MPC on Thursday, BOJ on Friday. The key point is, hello, rate cuts at last. It's been a tough couple of years, and markets are getting excited.
How much more excitement is there in the market? I mean, typically we kind of see this in the build-up to any major decision where markets start to anticipate what could come out. If tomorrow comes around and we get a 50 basis point rate cut, how much of a frenzy is that going to cause in the equity space?
This does look like by the rumor sold in you. In other words, you're getting excited ahead of this, and then tomorrow we get a rate cut from Jerome Powell and his team, and everyone's like, well, now what? And we start selling into what's been already S&P's trading at all-time highs, NASDAQ top 40 just off all-time highs. You say markets the world over have been running, and this does very much look like we're going to run, and we'll probably run tomorrow as well, and then tomorrow evening, rather, after the Fed statement, which will be 8:30 our time, I think markets are going to take a bit of a breather. They've got quite frothy. And let's be clear, Jimmy, you've been talking interest rate cuts. I mean, what? They were supposed to start in January. We're now in September. The story's long in the tooth to a degree, and I think markets will sell off. But I also want to stress, you know, not a bear market. We'll see a sell off. There is no sense here that we're going to start moving into bear markets. It'll just be a buy the rumor, sell the news type of scenario.
So we will see some form of pullback, but overall markets remain optimistic. Along with that optimism, we got consumer confidence data in South Africa that suggests that consumer confidence is at a five-year high. Clearly, the consumer market also desperately looking forward to those rate cuts, even though that data would have come out a long time before we knew for certain that we were getting these cuts.
100%. There's a lot as a South African consumer to be more confident about. Eskom, thank you for the electricity. The two-pot, I mean, by Wednesday last week, we had 160,000 withdrawals for what, 4.1 billion. That adds some confidence to it. Inflation is down, and as you say, the expectation that rates would start coming down. Maybe we had hoped it would be July, but it looks like September. And I think there's a fair bit to start getting consumers just that little more confident. I mean, more news today that the all things equal, if they stay as they are, we get another plus one rand cut on petrol in October. It's been after a tough four and a half years for people, South Africans, it's been a surprisingly positive and good 6 months. So consumer sentiment improving didn't surprise me. That does make sense.
Clearly, we have much to be optimistic about. Hopefully, that optimism does last and does translate into some positive movements. Simon, I want to look at some of the movements that took place throughout the day today. OUTsurance giving us some numbers today, and the market absolutely loving those numbers.
Absolutely. I mean, short-term insurers are a great product because they really have pricing flexibility. They essentially redo your policy every 6 months and every 12 months and decide whether or not you're going to pay more or less depending on their risk. Earnings, normalized earnings up 20% and some change. The full-year dividend almost 30% higher. And then just for the heck of it, a special dividend of 40 cents. And to me, the weirdest part was they paid a special dividend last year as well. That was only 8.5 cents, but nonetheless. Australia doing well, South Africa doing great. Ireland still costing lots of money, but that's very, very new in their world. Life doing nicely. They essentially cross-selling products to existing clients. And overall, a good set of numbers and a stock that is trading as OUTsurance at an all-time high.
Speaking of things that aren't going as rosy as people might have thought, we got Metair confirmation, or Metair rather gave us a SENS announcement saying that they've decided to exit their Turkey business. They aren't too happy with some of the performances that they've seen in the region, but most likely a big factor there is the hyperinflation in that environment. What does that suggest about what we've seen some of the other companies do? We've seen a couple of companies that operate beyond South Africa's borders saying that in markets of uncertainty or hyperinflation, it might not be worth sticking around.
Absolutely. And this business for Meta, I think, has long been problematic. It was mostly selling into Russia. A decade ago, when Russia invaded Crimea, things got a little sticky. Of course, they got a whole lot worse 2.5 years ago when they invaded Ukraine. There's also the Turkish lira, which has been under significant pressure. And then, as you mentioned, the problem with the hyperinflation. So them exiting isn't a surprise. I suppose the question more is, I thought they might have done it a little bit sooner. They're getting a nice chunk of change, and certainly the market price priced the stock up 7%. To your point around sort of globalization, the problem is, and we've seen it MTN, they've got a great business in Nigeria, but the Nigerian naira has collapsed, and that means their profits from there are down, what, a third or a half, and truthfully, not going to recover back to previous levels relative to naira strength. And international expansions are difficult. Then maybe you say, well, okay, next go to a stable currency, and next go to Europe or the US. You go to the US, that is the absolute hotbed of capitalism, and you're perhaps even less likely to succeed just because it's tough. CEOs are very good at knowing what they do, but as soon as you step beyond the immediate, it gets a lot harder than most people expect.
And as you say this, I think of examples in the US, in the case of Sasol and the Lake Charles project. I think of Poland and the spa business deciding to exit Poland as well. Definitely interesting times when businesses operate in other regions. I think of almost all of the mining companies that have elected to pursue efforts in Australia, not having the best time there. Speaking of those mining companies, Platinum Counters seemingly still fighting the good fight. They've been under a lot of pressure and they're finally getting some breathing room.
Yeah, so let me give you our top three movers in the top 40. Implats up 9.1, Spania 8.2, Northam 8.1. Another very strong day. That followed on the back of Thursday and Friday when they were incredibly strong. Yesterday, a bit of a pause there. I've got to say, so let's look at the PGMs. I think there's two things driving the story here. One, I just think chronically oversold and a very strong bounce from oversold. Let's be clear about that. Very strong. If we look at the PGMs, platinum is just going sideways. It continues to go sideways. Sub $1,000 an ounce has been doing for a number of years. Palladium at current levels, call it $1,080, run nicely or support. It's at an interesting juncture. If palladium can keep on going, and of course, we had Sibanye-Stillwater last week say they're going to remove palladium production. If that carries on going, then I mean, 1250, even 1350 for palladium is possible, and that is very much going to excite our miners. We've got to remember we mostly mine platinum, not palladium. We've also seen rhodium ticking up a little bit, so you know it's only up to 4,800. But it started the year at around 4,250, so a little bit of an increase there. Small amounts of rhodium being mined, but the PGM bulls, I suppose we call them, are very excited, and there might be more upside here. Personally, I'm not involved, but watch that palladium price. If it can break through the immediate resistance, it could do another 15%, and that will see more upside in these very oversold stocks.
Si, before I let you go, the South African picture kind of looks rosy on all fronts. Are there any sectors that might be lagging in your view that you think might underperform if we do start to see a bit of a run in the markets?
There are some laggers. I think broadly the sectors that are running up are pretty much the correct one. REITs, real estate investment trusts. They run because with government rates coming down, where do you find yield? Well, you buy property stocks. And they started running October last year. We've seen it in local retailers, ShopRite at 300, Mr. Price, the Fashini Group, all have been running well this year as well. In the small cap space, it's more of a mixed bag. We've even seen the motor dealerships, Motus, Combined Motor, have been running as well. We've seen the moves. The you know what we're talking about now, the 6 months of good news. When we sat back in January, okay, load shedding aside, I honestly didn't have that on my bingo card for 2024. But there was a path there for South Africa, which was very positive, and there certainly were investors and have been investors. I think the laggers are mostly lagging for broadly the right reasons. They will get lifted as well. Rising tide lifts all ships. But I'm still disliking the winning sectors. We could be in for, I don't call it a golden period, but we could be in for a better period for SA Inc. in South Africa over the next couple of years.
The road looks bright and it does look like we're going to be in for some really sunny days on SA Inc. Thanks so much for the time and for the insight, Simon. As always, that's Simon Brown, founder at Just One Lap, joining me to reflect on the market movements throughout today, as well as share some thoughts around what lies ahead.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
The local equity market has delivered muted returns in recent years as structural challenges, including load shedding and persistently weak economic growth, fostered a difficult environment. With the elections behind us and the government of unity finding its feet, many investors are taking a new look at South African equities. Join the SAFM Market Update tomorrow evening at 6:45 as Allan Gray Portfolio Manager Tim Acker delves into the local equity market's prospects, exploring the challenges and the opportunities. Brought to you by Allan Gray. 50 years of long-term investing. Allan Gray is an authorized financial services provider.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
The time was 7:30 this morning before market open when Hyprop gave us their results for the year ended 30 June 2024. There were some interesting announcements, including a final dividend that they are paying as a cash dividend. I'm joined on the line by Morne Wilkin, the CEO of Hyprop, to reflect on the numbers and try and make sense of the company's performance over the last year. Good evening, Morne. Lovely to speak to you again. It's been less than a month since we last spoke, but thankfully this time we get to speak about the numbers. Your reflections on the year that was?
We had a very good year, Jimmy. I think, as we mentioned to the market, we exceeded our guidance. And in terms of our interims, we were quite hesitant where the market would go in March. I mean, you had the elections that was going to happen. There was high inflation. Interest rates was quite sticky. So we thought we adjusted our guidance to about 15 to 20%. And due to the good, excellent performance, actually, of our European portfolio as well as our South African portfolio, we have only had a reduction in our distributable income per share of 8.6% to 370 cents. So it's a very much a good surprise for us. And I do think we are set up to actually see nice growth going forward. We set ourselves as a management team a number of priorities we wanted to put in place, and we have delivered on most of those. And therefore, I think we've done the right things slowly but surely.
Morne, when we look at the portfolio performance, overall, it is quite a pleasing performance, as you mentioned. What about the vacancies? What about the tenants' relationships or the tenant agreements that you have in place? How is that kind of shaping up for the SA business and the offshore business? And while we're looking at that, let's touch on the 600 million rand or 600 million rand that you paid down in debt in the European business.
If we start off on vacancies, we're very fortunate. Our centres are doing exceptionally well. I mean, the vacancy on our South African portfolio is only 1.8%. In our European business, it's 0.1%, so it's very low. And I think it always gives you a bit of flexibility to move some tenants around and bring in some new tenants. In terms of our tenants, they are trading well. One of the things you do look at to see whether your tenant is doing well or not is what we call the effort ratio. We have successfully reduced our effort ratio from June 2020, where it was about 11.3, and I'm now speaking about our South African portfolio, and it reduced to 8.7%. So that is very positive, and what it means is there is opportunity to actually increase your rentals in time to come.
Morne, when we look at some of the reductions from a operating perspective, I remember the last time you and I caught up around results last year, and even in the interims, we discussed the drive to sort of go green from a business perspective and reduce the reliance on municipalities and Eskom for electricity and that sort of thing. I see there's been a 33% reduction in the electricity from municipalities and Eskom. Take me through the initiatives that you continue to put in place to ensure that Hyprop is sustainable.
Big thing we're doing at our centres is actually installing solar. So we've installed solar at all our Gauteng centres as well as solar at our newly acquired Table Bay Mall. That is the one thing that can actually bring a lot of savings across. And then you're also bringing in other electricity savings initiatives by bringing in certain globes that is more efficient than other things. And then you put off your lights and you actually regulate it like that. Water is the next big thing. I think we are focusing on that quite a bit. We have had a reduction of about 12% on our water usage, but that is something that is on the radar to focus on at this point in time.
Morne, when we look at the rest of the business, and you touched on this a little while ago to say that you are feeling a little more optimistic around just the conditions that you operate under at the moment, and the markets seem to absolutely love that there's a return to positive guidance that's come out of the management team. Just in time for rate cuts, I suppose, just in time for the government of national unity to start gaining some traction. What are you seeing? How are you seeing the landscape shaping up?
No, I think, Jimmy, you're quite right. I think what we do have as a business is a number of tailwinds, as you touched on interest rates. If interest rates starts coming down, it will be really beneficial. We have got positive rent reversions, meaning our rentals are increasing. We've got positive traction in terms of Europe. So all of those benefits are coming through. And we have got a step closer to exit Africa, which will be a big benefit for us. I think from a financial point of view, as well as management time being spent on Africa, where you could actually focus on the core business going forward.
Yeah, that West Africa exit that we spoke about last time is certainly well on its way at this stage. Morne, the business declared a final dividend of 2.80 a share, even though distributable income per share was down quite a bit. Take me through the strategy here. Take me through, obviously, you're being optimistic, or you're seeing some optimism going forward, but just take me through the distributions and how the business is positioned at the moment.
Yeah, what we've our dividend policy, we pay out 75% of our distributable income coming from South Africa as well as Eastern Europe. And that is the 75% of the 370. Effectively, it's not completely the 370 because that has got some Africa in that as well, but that comes to the 280. So we actually, in line with our dividend policy, we pay out 75% of our distributable income. The 25% we actually use to reduce debt. And as you mentioned, we have successfully reduced about 600 million in our Eastern Europe in-country debt. And that's specifically how the policy has been set up. We retain the money in Europe, we amortize those loans, and we pay back as quickly as possible. And what we then do is we pay out 100% of South Africa's distributable income, and we top it up from Europe. So we keep most of the money in Europe to reduce that debt, and that will actually also create gearing capacity again on our SA portfolio going forward.
Morne, Hyprop has now been one of the few companies to return back to giving forecasts. I miss the days where we used to get forecasts out of companies, and I think the pandemic and everything with interest rates definitely put a dampener on that. But I see forecasts are back in the SENS announcements, even though they are conditional forecasts. The business is sitting quite comfortably with 800 million rand in cash available, as well as facilities available on top of that. Take me through the outlook into the new financial year. What's the thinking, where's the strategy, what kind of priorities are being put in place at the moment?
Yeah, I think we're just to clarify, we call it guidance. It's not a complete forecast. We know we do a forecast internally, but based on that forecast, we give some guidance what we think can happen in the market. And I think there is a positive movement going in the right direction. I touched on that. I think there are a lot of tailwinds that's coming in, and that will drive the business to actually have much better growth going forward.
That West African business that you that we spoke about last time, about you exiting from that business, once that exit kind of wraps itself up and you're unwinding the positions from that perspective, is there interest in exploring a different geographical area, or are Europe and South Africa kind of enough for now?
I think that is our key focus at this point in time. I think what we have done in South Africa, there is a bigger focus on the Western Cape and in Eastern Europe. What we will maybe do in time to come is reduce our exposure in Gauteng, but definitely not any other jurisdictions at this point in time. Because I think you need to create economies of scale when you go into a new jurisdiction. And I think Europe and South Africa actually gives us a nice diversification. And therefore, at this point in time, we wouldn't explore going somewhere else. Something we have been investigating sometimes is, do you bring in some other asset classes within your portfolio? For example, is a mix of industrial and retail maybe something nice or something like that? But I don't think from an area perspective we will change.
That's very interesting from a business that's looking to optimize its strategy going forward. We look forward to seeing how that strategy optimization pans out. We'll stay in touch and keep an eye on these developments. Thank you so much for the time and for the insights, Morne. That's Morne Wilkin, who is the CEO at Hyprop, joining me to reflect on the year that was for them, as well as what lies ahead in the new year.
Hello, Jeremy Maggs here. I've just finished recording the next episode of Fix SA on MoneyWeb. I'm in conversation with the former chief executive of the Johannesburg Stock Exchange and soldier, Roy Anderson. We'll be looking at leadership style and approach when it comes to solving problems, comparing the role of discipline in military and civilian leadership and strategies for setting and achieving goals under pressure.
Join me, Jeremy Maggs, and South Africa's top leaders on the fortnightly MoneyWeb Fix SA podcast. Listen on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
And we're taking a look at Itala Bank, the institution that has been operating for quite some time and facilitating some transactions primarily in the KZN province. I believe it is a state-owned institution. They'd been going for a banking license for some time, and there've been some developments out of that stable from the Prudential Authority announcing that part of the reasons why that exemption was not continuously granted or was not renewed at this stage, rather, was because of the systems that Itala was running. As you know, I like to bring in a banking specialist when we discuss all things banking, and I thought we'd chat to our resident banking specialist, director at Denker Capital, Kuki Koyman, around this and try and understand what's going on here. Good evening, Kuki. Lovely to speak to you as always. Let's start with a bit of an update around Itala as it stands. Is the bank operational? Is the institution kind of still running at the moment?
Hi, Jimmy. I assume it's still running because the Prudential Authority did appoint someone to also do investigations and to curb the special license they had to take deposits. But that means they can't take new deposits, but they can still continue. And my last understanding was that they can still continue making new loans. But obviously you need to fund them, and you've got to fund them from repayment from old loans. So you're actually circulating money, which is very tough. So the bank has been severely curbed. But the concern now has been that in the Prudential Authority's report to the Parliamentary Standing Committee on Finance, that didn't, as you said, it didn't renew the license for it to, or the special permission for it to allow it to take deposits because of a few reasons. The one is the one that we've known in the background the whole time is that the bank was having liquidity or solvency issues. It wasn't profitable. In fact, it's now, I see the loss for the last 2 years is 520 million rand. And that means that shareholders have got to put in 520 million rand to enable the bank just to operate profitably again. But the new concern, and I suppose that's having spent time there now that the PA is coming to these conclusions or insights, is that the operating systems on which the bank operates are very old, and in fact are so old that the software supplier that originally supplied them and is not named has discontinued doing software renewals or maintenance on those systems, and that opens the bank to a lot of risk. It can't report properly to the Prudential Authority, and it also opens it to cyber crime or cyber attacks. Okay, now it gets really interesting, because in the report it said that the bank had suffered a number of cyber attacks causing financial loss. Secondly, it also says that it had spent 37.5 million on trying to upgrade its systems. It seems like a Mahindra was used, but that money is gone and nothing was done. So now there are two allegations, one of misallocation of funding for a tech project which wasn't done, which is also, the supervisor says, not being tried to collect the money back, or nothing is being done to get the money back. Okay, the CEO now, Tulani Vilakazi of Itala, says that is not true. He says that there have been no cyber attacks and hence no losses from cyber attacks, and also that a civil case and a criminal case has been opened and that process is underway to try and recover that 37.5 million. So it's a bit worrying when you've got two direct contradictions there as to what's actually happening. But the bottom line is, it is worrying that the bank's operating systems are old and not totally functional. But it seems to have been able to operate on those systems. And so I suppose for a while it can continue to operate, but it does make it vulnerable.
Kwaki, when we look at the banks or the clients of the bank, people still have their deposits there. The bank still has north of or just shy of 3 billion rand in deposits from customers and the additional loans that they've got out there. What does that mean for customers if the bank is not able to get its exemption back from the Prudential Authority because it's also had its FSCA license suspended as well?
Quite correct. So, I mean, that is the whole reason why the Reserve Bank normally appoints a curator or appoints somebody to go in and take charge to protect depositors. And effectively, because the depositors stand to lose their deposits unless the government bails them out. Now it comes into the whole realm of deposit insurance, which I'm not sure if the bank has complied with that yet and where it is. So depositors could lose their money, their deposits, but the whole reason for appointing someone is to prevent that happening and to ensure that we don't have a so-called run on the bank. Because once depositors do panic and they start taking their money out, then the bank is gone. And then it's basically a case of a few days, was once people start saying the money isn't safe, you must take it out. And even a conversation like this is actually dangerous because it could trigger something like that. And that's why it's very important, I think, that the Reserve Bank and the bank should come with a clear statement as to that deposits are safe and where depositors stand. I think this is going to be critical with the news flow surrounding the bank increasing post that report to Parliament.
Kwaki, as a banking expert, I want to get your thoughts on the state of Itala as a whole. Did the bank kind of sit on its hands for too long? I mean, the understanding behind an exemption is that it's granted so that other conditions can be met and so that at some point the bank can obtain a full banking license. Itala has been operating under an exemption for north of 10 years. Can we understand why that's the case? Did the bank not make an effort to get the licensing or to meet the requirements for the licensing?
Yeah, not enough is known at this stage. I would assume so. And one can look, if you read between the lines in terms of the information that's becoming available, that the bank, the criticism against the bank is also that its operating costs are too high. Its infrastructure for what it was trying to do is too big, and therefore the costs are too high, and that's why the bank is running at an annual loss. So I would assume that the bank, when it started, had really good projections and objectives to grow the bank and to grow into, and for that you needed these systems. But from then on, for the last 10 years, it's been running at a loss, and so there's never been money to upgrade the systems and to fulfill the requirements that the Reserve Bank wants you to be able to get a deposit, a full-blown deposit license. And I think that's really what's happened. The bank never grew or met its targets of what it wanted to do and then just fell into a trap. I mean, that's what it seems at the outside. To date, there'd been no mention actually of, besides the operating expenditure spent on systems, but there's no mention so far of fraudulent activity as we had with VBS. Yeah, so in that regard, the bank seems sound. It's got, I think, almost 300 stock files operating on it. A large amount, 40%, I think, of its assets is home loans, which also is fairly safe. So I think the bank itself is okay. It just never maybe had the right management or never the right environment to allow it to grow into what it wanted to do.
Kwaki, now that the bank has got a payments administrator appointed and there's a couple of interventions that are being put in place by the Prudential Authority and the like, does this mean that we could potentially see a change in management? How does the process kind of work from here if the Prudential Authority is not happy with the outcomes?
Yeah, certainly. The payment administrator and whoever the team that it's also obviously sent in to do more work will come back with a report. And so far I deduce from the parliamentary committee's feedback that there was no conclusion or no recommendation yet, because else that would have been. But normally you would say if in fact there had been maladministration and fraud or actually simply incompetence, then you should replace management. But that's also not that easy. You don't find good bankers under every bush, although there are a few ones that have retired now that might be available to come in on a standing basis. But we could see how long it took the Land Bank just to get back onto its feet again, as an example. So, but I think it's important that action gets taken and that more disclosure is made. I think especially for clients and depositors, they have the right to know, is the bank going to sustain, is it going to survive, because else they should switch their business.
Well, we'll certainly keep an eye on that, and we'll certainly hope that we get some insights from the relevant authorities. Thank you so much, Corky, for your insights. Always a pleasure speaking to you. That's Corky Kooiman, a director at Denker Capital, on the latest developments out of Itala Bank.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
We're taking a look at Starlink. There's been a lot of rumors circulating that we will finally get Elon Musk's Starlink in South Africa. Those rumors have been circulating for quite some time. ICASA denying that Starlink has applied for it or for a license. Elon Musk saying that he has applied for a license. There's been a lot of back and forth and confusion. And I thought, let's clarify that. Let's see what we know and let's see where we stand at the moment. I'm joined on the line by Deputy Editor at My Broadband, Hanu Labaskakhni, to take a look at this. Good evening, Hanu. Thanks so much for taking the time. Let's start with where we are now and where we were sort of a couple of weeks ago before all of the back and forth began.
Well, yeah, there's been some big changes, Jimmy, in the last couple of weeks. There's been no word from SpaceX for a long time about what will happen with Starlink in South Africa. Actually, from late 2022, they changed the availability of the service on their official coverage map from an estimated launch in 2023 to unknown. And that sort of left people in the dark. What was also mysterious is that South Africa wasn't completely removed. It was a part of a small cohort of countries that had an unknown ETA. And presumably that unknown ETA was due to some uncertainty from SpaceX's side regarding the process of approval in South Africa and how laborious it would be given our ownership rules for telecoms licensees. But now, over the past few weeks, it seems that a comment from Mr. Elon Musk himself, the CEO of SpaceX, has sort of spurred more stories and reports about Starlink officially, looking to get approval in South Africa. We have heard that ICASA has said it has not applied for a license. But we have some high-placed government sources and our president himself confirming that discussions are potentially underway and that he's spoken to Mr. Musk himself. So a lot of developments, and it all sort of started with just a seemingly inconspicuous tweet or reply by Musk himself to someone in South Africa who asked for the service to be available. I believe it's a farmer who asked, when are we getting it? And then Musk just said, awaiting approval in South Africa. And that sort of started the ball rolling. And then we got the official word from President Ramaphosa that they are looking at getting approval in South Africa.
Now, Hanu, one of the things, as you mentioned, that seemed to be a bit of a delay initially in the process was the uncertainty around the ownership. And there were obviously rumors circulating that there would need to be a certain level of ownership that would be BEE ownership and those sorts of conditions, and Starlink seemingly not happy with that, and that went back and forth. ICASA's last standpoint was that they haven't received an application.
Yes, that is correct. They haven't received an application, according to them. That was about a week ago we got the last confirmation. Of course, things can change quite a bit during that time. It might simply be that ICASA is not aware that the Starlink directors in charge of seeking approval are in the country and are speaking to individuals in government that might not necessarily be at ICASA itself, although ICASA is the regulator. Of course, they will have to. They are tasked with getting the approval. So it will be interesting to see how this whole thing plays out, whether it's being driven by the Department of Communications and Digital Technologies. We've had some word from Minister Malatsi alluding to potentially entering into discussions with Starlink a couple of weeks ago in an interview we had with him. He said there was no, he could find no active engagement
between his department and SpaceX, and that people could expect some of that to change and some developments in this area. Of course, we're waiting for official confirmation that this has happened, but we have some highly placed sources that are saying that even though ICASA is not aware of the application proceeding, there are some high-level discussions potentially already happening or happening in the near future to get that approval. Now, it will be a big challenge given the current rules of the ECA, the Electronic Communications Act, which determines that a company that wants to hold a license, an electronic communication services license, needs to be 30% owned by historically disadvantaged groups. So that can include Black people, people with disabilities, women and youth. But ICASA has also proposed these new regulations that will replace that effectively with 30% Black ownership. So you'll have to have 30% Black ownership. Now, you can imagine for an international company like Starlink, actually a US-based company, where these types of rules are not a factor, it's quite challenging if you want to launch directly into the market and offer your services. And their business model is a bit different from other international companies that have launched via subsidiaries or through partners. Starlink doesn't want to do that. They don't want to lose control of the customer interaction, and they feel that if they introduce third parties in between them and the customer, it will increase the cost of the service, and they also lose some control over the customer service element. So it will be interesting to see how they tackle this particular blockade, and if it will eventually mean that Starlink will partner. But what is clear is that the current licensees in the country will probably not be happy if Starlink is granted some sort of special exemption. And I don't think that will allow for fair competition.
I know. Let's look at that cost and let's look at them coming into the market potentially. Does the price point that Starlink has in mind look attractive to consumers? Is it a good price point for you and I to look at when looking at service providers?
So in answering that question, one has to look at Starlink's target market. Their target market is not people that are living in metros or cities or even towns. With, alternative forms of communication, well, forms of broadband like fiber and fixed LTE and fixed 5G. We've got a plethora of broadband solutions in these areas. Starlink is aimed primarily at serving those locations that don't have any other forms of connectivity or might have had satellite connectivity, but satellite connectivity, traditional satellite connectivity via geosynchronous satellites is simply it cannot reach the speeds or capabilities of Starlink. Starlink has got much higher speeds. We're talking about over 100 megabits per second. So it's fiber-like in its speed, and its latency in South Africa at the moment is about 200 milliseconds, but that's already much better than 600 or 700 milliseconds. And that makes applications like video conferencing and video calling and online gaming much more possible. So firstly, you need to look at the market that it's aiming for. And in that market, Starlink is unbeatable in terms of value and price because the competing satellite services, all the satellite services, they're effectively just much, much more expensive per megabit per second. And also they've got these stringent fair usage policies on their packages, which limit your speeds after a certain amount of usage in the month. And Starlink doesn't really do that. So in that area, they are very competitive. And now what's interesting in Africa, the subscriptions are typically priced, you know, around, I think about 500 to 1,000 Rand per month, which might sound like a lot for, you know, people living in rural areas that are poor. But we already see some people in the middle of Africa, in Kenya and those countries, sharing their Starlink connections with each other and then distributing the cost within the community. And the Starlink dish sort of like acting like a central Wi-Fi access point for people in the community. And then also where it recently launched in Zimbabwe, it actually has a subscription price of about $30, which is around 500 Rand, which is highly competitive with entry-level fiber in South Africa. And one must keep in mind that in Zimbabwe, Fiber prices are much higher. Broadband prices are much higher than in South Africa. So it's actually a very, very compelling offering there. And they've also got a dish that the upfront equipment is quite expensive, but they've got a mini dish that is much more affordable than their regular dish. Their regular dish is around 6,000 to 7,000 rand for the service, for the kit. But this mini kit is around 3,000 rand in Zimbabwe when converted from US dollars. So it is looking like they are going to be very aggressive on pricing in South Africa and making it as accessible as possible for people that aren't necessarily able to afford it in rural areas. But we must also remember that there are many businesses in rural areas that can afford Starlink and would benefit significantly from it. And we're talking about businesses that have significant financial means, but the level of service they've seen with satellite has been abysmal. I'm talking about literally mines working in remote areas, safari lodges like five-star safari lodges, those typically bordering the Kruger, which want to give their guests really good Wi-Fi, and then also like rural schools that might that are able to get some government funding to finance this, but drastically improve connectivity for their learners.
Well, here's to a more connected world, a more connected country. We'll wait and see how this shapes up. Certainly some interesting times lie ahead for all of us. I think we'll leave it at that, Hanu. Thanks so much for the time and for the insights. That's Hanu Labuschagne, Deputy Editor at My Broadband, on the Starlink debacle and where we stand.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
It's another Tuesday. It's either Property Tuesdays or Agri Tuesdays, as you know them. And this week is the turn of Property Tuesdays. We're going to be taking a look at the real cost of renting. I'm joined on the line by PayProp's General Manager for Group Sales, Michelle Dickens, to take a look at this. Good evening, Michelle. Thanks so much for taking the time. Let's start by understanding the property market at the moment. Are people sort of renting more or buying more at the moment?
You know, Jimmy, it's such a personal preference. And it depends on your lifestyle stage, whether you're a student, whether you're retiring, going into retirement, getting your first job, migration across the country. There's so many personal choices that determine if you as an individual want to rent or you want to buy. But when we look at it from a more of a macro version, what we see out there in the market at the moment is 24% of, let's call it one in four, households prefer to rent at the moment. It's a number that's been growing, and it's driven by many different reasons. On a more macro level, for example, we've got high interest rates, and that encourages people to stay in rental accommodation for longer, waiting for those interest rates to come back down again. We also see the tenants are becoming older. So traditionally, you would move out in your 20s, and we're seeing that that's extended all the way into the 30s. And affordability does start to drive that. Generational aspects of that are people become more transient. So a lot of tenants are more comfortable to live the rental lifestyle than the home ownership lifestyle. But effectively, the question, one in four tenants happy to be in a rental accommodation at the moment.
When we think about property and we think about property purchases, there's all sorts of fees and things involved around transfer duties and all of that. But when we discuss rental properties, there's a few fees that we actually don't know exist in the rental space. Take us through some of those.
Yeah, so every fee that a tenant needs to pay, those fees need to be reduced to writing and recorded in your lease agreement. Otherwise, we simply can't charge them as an industry, as investors or landlords. So the type of fees that a tenant typically used to pay is, I know what the rent is, on average, it's 30% of an individual's income that they spend towards their rental accommodation, being the basic rental. But then on top of that, tenants need to budget for water, they need to budget for electricity. And as a homeowner, you're going to be budgeting for things like maintenance of the property, levies on the property, sewerage, refuse removal, rates and taxes, all of those on the property. So the landlord also has costs that they're budgeting for. However, some costs are then passed on to the tenant. For example, in your rates and taxes, we're going to pass on the costs of sewerage onto the tenant. Sewerage, pickup, refuse removal, those kind of costs as well. So tenants are starting to learn that they need to budget for those in addition. On top of that, of course, is the process of signing the tenant on. So in the market, tenants need to start thinking about budgeting for the cost of the lease agreement. So there's often a cost that the tenant pays up front for signing the lease agreement, the contract fee it's often called. Tenants are often asked to pay an application fee. So we've shown you the property, you want to go to the point of application. An application fee is now common in the market where there's costs associated with determining if you want to take the tenant on or not. Once you're secured in the property, of course, then there's the inspection fees. Now, the inspection fee is really important because both tenant and landlord are required to do a joint incoming and a joint outgoing inspection in terms of the law. And so where these costs are associated with, sometimes it's to the landlord and sometimes it's to the tenant. For example, often the incoming inspection fee is charged to the landlord and the outgoing inspection fee is charged to the tenant. So these are some of the costs that the tenant should be thinking about. But of course, all of them will be included in the lease agreement so that the tenant isn't blindsided by costs that they don't know are coming.
I like that you bring up that lease agreement, Michelle. I want to look at some of the other things that renters or potential tenants should be discussing with a potential landlord prior to moving in so that you're not blindsided by the lease. Obviously, it's important to read your lease agreement and read it thoroughly, but are there kind of questions you can be asking your landlord? Are there certain clauses you should be wary of in a lease agreement?
Jimmy, you're 100% correct. So in South Africa, a lease agreement can be verbal. So a tenant and a landlord can enter into a verbal lease agreement, but it's always better to reduce it to writing because this is where disputes often arise when it's not reduced to writing. So the clauses that tenants should pay particular attention to, for example, are if I'm renting with a friend or a colleague and I enter into a lease agreement, this lease agreement is generally jointly and severally, the tenants are generally jointly and severally liable. In other words, if one friend pays and the other friend doesn't pay, the paying friend often gets surprised to hear that they are liable for the non-paying friend's part of the rent. So it's important when we're looking at the lease agreement and I'm going to rent with a friend, am I jointly and severally liable for the rent? Because then I'm liable for my friend in the event that they don't pay. That's often a surprise. The other one is how rent must be paid and where it must be paid to. That seems simple enough, right? It must be paid on the first. It must often have cleared the landlord's bank account on the first. So when you've got interbank delays, because you're paying out of one bank into another bank, it's important that that is then taken into consideration as a tenant. And more importantly, because this is such an interesting fact about tenant payments, tenants often use a generalized rent as their reference. Instead of using what is the correct reference number that's been allocated to me, so when I pay my rent, it can be automatically allocated to my landlord and dispersed to my landlord, and then the tenant, and here's where it's important for the tenant, won't be held liable, for example, for interest for non-payment because the rent hasn't been able to be allocated to their account simply because they used the wrong reference number. So that's a really, really important one. And then, Jimmy, my third one is an important one because when we're moving into the property, it's all roses and everyone's happy. But tenants have the right to cancel their lease early. And often when they cancel the lease early, it's a big surprise to hear that they have a penalty or damages charge that's levied against them. So it's important to understand, if I'm going to cancel my lease early, does my lease make provision for what those costs could be?
Certainly a lot of costs to take into account, costs when you sign up with a landlord or enter into an agreement, but also some surprise costs if you are intending to lease with other individuals. Michelle, before I let you go, I want to look at the costs or potential costs associated with subleasing. I know this is a very interesting topic or an interesting angle towards the rental space because you have to get the landlord's permission before you do these sorts of things, but are there specific costs that can be incurred over and above your normal rental costs when you are subleasing?
Yeah, costs. Subleasing is a really important part of that lease agreement that you want to read up front. Subleasing is generally, in most residential lease agreements, prohibited because the landlord wants to ensure that who is placed in the property will be able to pay the rent. So they're going to go through the affordability process, etc. Often subleasing used to be in years gone by when a tenant was in a fixed term lease agreement for 12 months and they didn't have the option for early cancellation.
Unfortunately, we've run out of time. We're going to have to leave that conversation there. Thank you so much for the time and for the insights, Michelle. That's Michelle Dickens, General Manager for Sales at PayProp, joining me for this week's property segment. It's just gone exactly 7 o'clock. Greg Hose is standing by with the latest round of evening news, followed by Michael Abramson and the top sport team. From my side, good night.